Today we're going to begin, and it's going to be kind of a little brief today as an introduction, because we'll be looking in these next few weeks, next couple of months maybe even, at some of the miracles that Jesus performed during his life here on earth. And we're going to do this for a couple of reasons and a couple of perspectives I want to throw out today. One is because it's not uncommon for us in this life to get to that place where we feel that we need to be reminded that God is a miracle-working God. The scripture is very clear that when Jesus was here, part of what was going on with him was the ability of God's presence in the midst of our circumstances to begin to alter those circumstances in ways that we were not expecting, that even those in his day did not expect to see happening. Now, 2,000 years later, we often kind of put those into a box and say, that happened then, it doesn't happen anymore. But the reality is that the word impossible is not in God's vocabulary. That Jesus, who did miracles then, is still present for us to do miracles today. And we need to be reminded from time to time not to give up, because this Jesus whom we follow is able. And I want you to hear that today. Because I don't know all of what's going on in the midst of all of our various lives, but I know that there are circumstances and challenges and griefs that sometimes seem too big, and we think, well, maybe I'm just going to have to bear it because God can't do anything about it. Reality is, God can, and the Gospels are here to remind us that God does. So we need not to give up hope. We're going to start with this premise that Jesus was about doing these things, not because he wanted to show off, but because they began to reveal something larger, began to do something about who God was in our midst. And these things, too, we are called to be reminders of. The gospel writers didn't record every miracle that he did, but they chose to include certain ones. And we're going to start with the very first one today. And it's an interesting one. I'll have to just say it's one of my favorite miracles in all the Bible. And I think it's just kind of fascinating because it is odd to me. I mean, I think of all the things that Jesus did, and if you're new to Jesus, then you may not know all of these, but you know, there were times when Jesus was on this earth and he did amazing things like feeding thousands of people at one time with just, you know, 5 loaves of bread, little loaves, and 2 fish. There were amazing times when he would heal the sick, when he would raise the dead, when he would walk on water. Okay, I get it. Those things seem so crazy to us that we almost put them in another category. But the reality is, for those who were there, this was jaw-dropping. It was eye-opening. It was life-changing, because these are the things that Jesus did. And yet today we're going to start off with the one that the gospel writer John picked to be the very first miracle to lead us into this. And it was the day that Jesus turned water into wine. What's up with that? You know, if you're going to pick all the different miracles that Jesus did, and you're going to do a like a baseball coach does his lineup card, he doesn't just pick any old batter to bat first. Michael, who does he pick? His son. Yeah, his son. Yeah, when Little League, a coach, he always picks his son. I get it. Yeah, Daniel always batted lead off for me. But that's just, you know, that's what we do. But, okay, get beyond the parental thing. What's a coach looking for when he wants a leadoff hitter? Speed, okay. Someone has got a chance maybe to... Somebody's going to get on base. Yeah, you don't really pick anybody. You got to pick somebody out. And John did the same thing. When he picked out, of all the miracles he's going to tell us about Jesus, he picks out this one on purpose. And it's kind of a weird one. We don't know what to do with it sometimes, do we? Jesus turned water into wine. What's that about? How important is that? Why didn't he just walk on water? Wouldn't that have been more impressive, a way to get things started? But we begin at a place in a little town called Cana that, honestly, if it hadn't been for this story, you and I would never have heard of this place. A little place called Cana, not far from Nazareth, in the region of Galilee. Okay, so we're going to start with chapter 2, verse 1 in the Gospel of John. On the third day, in other words, third day, it was on a Tuesday. What happens on Tuesdays? Anything? You know, Tuesdays are kind of a forgotten day, aren't they? Who said that? Taco Tuesday. Okay, we had to make something of it because nothing else ever happens on Tuesday. You do get a lot of stuff in the mail that day, doesn't it? Yeah, Tuesday's the day. Okay, well, Tuesday's the day now. Back then, things didn't happen much on Tuesday, so they didn't know what to do, so they decided they'd have a wedding on this day. The third day of the week, a wedding took place in Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there at the wedding, and Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. So we see this is how it's beginning, that we're getting a kind of a context here that there is a wedding going on. It's family and friends. Jesus and his mom are hanging out together, getting a little bit of mother and son bonding time at this wedding. And then something begins to go awry. When the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, "They have no more wine." Duh. Oh no! Now I know, when people begin reading the Gospel of John, sometimes they're a little struck. They're expecting to see these grand things, this Son of God on display, and they come to a common, ordinary thing like a wedding with a real kind of a, it doesn't sound like a big problem to me. Of course, if it was my party, I wouldn't want to run out of wine. I would look bad. They say, we should have known. We shouldn't have gone to that cheapskate John's party. We knew he wouldn't have enough wine. But no. Okay, so there's no wine. So then in verse 4, Jesus says, "Woman, why do you involve me?" Now, I love this. You know, I think I've heard Daniel say something like this to his mom, you know? "Woman, why do you involve me?" Or maybe better, "Woman, why are you involved in this?" You know, so I know how sons and moms can be. And so I hear this and I start thinking, hey, the old Jesus was just like every other son. But we're going to look at this a little bit more carefully, because this is really the kind of the key to opening up this passage, because it's easy for us to get distracted and not understand what Jesus was doing and John is trying to tell us about him. Okay, so, "Woman, why do you involve me?" Jesus replied, "My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." And nearby stood 6 stone jars, water jars, the kind used by the Jews for the ceremonial washing, each holding about 20 to 30 gallons. Do your math, okay? Do your math, and let's continue on. Okay. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water." So they filled them to the brim, and then he told them, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet." So they did. And the master of the banquet tasted the water that had been turned into wine, and he did not realize where it had come from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew. Huh. Then he called the bridegroom aside and said, "Everyone brings out the choice wine first, and then the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink." What's written in between the lines here is, "But you let us all get drunk first, and then you bring out the good stuff." What's going on here? The second chapter of this gospel, and we got people getting drunk. It doesn't fit with the way we think Jesus ought to operate. "But you have saved the best until now." What Jesus did here in Cana of Galilee was the first of the signs through which he revealed his glory, and here and now, the disciples believed in him. After this, he went down to Capernaum with his mother and brothers and disciples, and they stayed there for a few days. Okay, why would this be the first one? First, okay, let's break it down just real quick and look for some clues in this. There's a couple things of significance, I think, here before we get started. One, it is the third day, and this is going to play a little part, and we'll come back to that later. It's Tuesday. It's in Cana, which is near Nazareth. Mary, Jesus' mother, is there, and she obviously has some role. Maybe she knows these folks. Maybe she's helping out, because she seems to know something that no one else at the wedding knows, which is they're running out of wine, which means she must have been the one in charge of these things, such as having enough wine. And she goes to Jesus looking for him to somehow to fix this situation. Now, of course, as you know, you've probably heard sermons on this, wine at a wedding at that day was a big deal, and you didn't want to run out because there would be an embarrassment, kind of a stigma on your family from then on. And so it was really a big deal for the family, and they're on the edge of an embarrassment. Mary wants to intervene. She wants Jesus to help. Why did she ask Jesus? Did he have some connection with a wine wholesaler back in Nazareth or something? He'd get on a cell phone and call and get some more delivered? You know, why did she tell Jesus, hey, fix this situation? Maybe because he's her son. Maybe he's her oldest son. And so oldest sons, you know, have a responsibility in ancient Near East. It says it's his first miracle. Maybe had he done something similar that Mary was wondering. We don't know why, but she looks to him to fix this situation somehow, and Jesus is going to fix it, but I suggest to you not in the way that Mary would have expected. She's going to have to see this and begin to interact. Now, the interaction with his mom, isn't that a funny thing, that what she says? You know, I can almost hear it. If you were today to try to put it in our parlance, I would say something like, you know, like, you know, when Mary says, hey, Jesus, fix this problem, Jesus could probably say something like, yeah, yo, woman, you be tripping. This ain't none of my concern. You know, it's funny. It's a funny thing with Bible interpretation. As you look at this, this is what Jesus says if you simply do the words. The words are accurately interpreted from the Greek into our English. And as he says, it's really not my concern. My time has not come. That's the words. But what it means is something different. You know, it's like us. We sometimes say things that really literally can't be taken literally. For example, it was raining really hard one night, and so we call it raining cats and dogs. Have you ever said that? Now, fast forward 1,000 years and people in a different language, and they translate that and they're reading what you wrote. Oh, it was raining cats and dogs one night. They're going to say, cats and dogs were falling from the sky? Well, literally, that's what you said. But we know that's not exactly what it meant. But it's a phrase. And this, too, is a phrase. This woman, why do you concern me? Though it is a concern, it's not yet my time, can be interpreted in another way. And I'm going to suggest this to you. This is not my idea. It's someone much smarter than me. William Barclay, a number of years ago, put this, and he suggests that what it sounds like is this: don't worry. Not my concern. Don't worry. You don't quite understand what's going on. Leave things to me, and I will settle it in my own time, in my own way. Now it changes it a bit, because at times we think that Jesus is kind of putting Mary in her place and kind of saying, back off, this isn't for you to tell me what to do. You know, it's kind of pulling the I'm really, you know, God incarnate card on her. But that's not the case. What we see is that Jesus is hearing his mother's concern, and he's responding to the need that she feels. He's not being a bad son, telling mom to back off. He is being a good son who hears, who takes her thoughts into consideration, and is now going to respond, though not in the way that she expected. Don't worry, you don't quite understand what's going on here, so leave things to me, and I will settle them in my own way. You know, and this actually fits if you think about it, because you read the rest of the context. What does Mary say after this? After Jesus says, don't bother me, why would she tell the servants, do whatever he says? Unless he gave her something, unless there was something in this context that we miss in our English, that we are somehow overlooking, that Jesus is saying, don't worry, don't concern yourself, let me handle it. And she says to the servants, do whatever he says. And so it goes on. And of course, you see how it plays out. There's this abundance. And isn't that kind of the cool part of the story? Isn't that kind of the cool part of the story, that Jesus then begins to meet this need, but not in a way that she would have expected or that anyone would have expected? He is in the midst of this party when no one else even sees what happens, except for his disciples, his mom, and probably the servants, that he begins to meet the need, but with extravagance. I think that's part of what's going on here. This is why John opens up his gospel with it. He wants us to see Jesus revealing God to us in this way, that not only does God begin to meet felt needs, but he meets them in extravagant ways. There is an excess going on here. Did you catch the excess? Canaan is a little town. Maybe 100 people live there. Maybe everyone showed up for the wedding. How much wine does he make? Now, at the end of the party, who did their math? 120 to 180 gallons, you know, that's a pretty good supply of wine. That might get to the end of the day. This is a miracle of excess. It's as if God is saying, yes, I will meet your needs. You can trust me for this. In fact, I will even do better than your needs if you will trust me in this. Mary, you don't fully understand, but let me do this. I will show you. This is what begins to happen. There is this sense, as if we have this idea, don't we, that somehow that Christianity is kind of a buzzkill. It's going to take all the fun out of life. If we follow after Jesus, it's going to somehow steal from us the joy of life, steal from us the fun that we could have. I've heard people talk about that. I know people sometimes get this all confused because we have this idea that somehow to be Christian, you have to be serious, you have to be stern. There is a propriety about things. You know, there was a lady long time ago, E. Stanley Jones, was kind of like Franklin Graham of his era, and he was traveling around and he was doing his evangelism, and a lady came up to him after one of his outreaches, and she came up to him with this really, you know, pruny face. Which one is it? Pruny. Egg roll face. Yeah, whatever. Okay. It was something to eat, and it was not very pleasant. And she came up and she said, "Brother Stanley, the joy of the Lord is my strength." And I think she was hoping to impress him, you know? Yes. And Stanley Jones looked at her and said, "Well, if I were you, madam, I would inform my face." Because we get this. We are called to joy. We are called to extravagance. We are called to a life that is full and complete. You know, we see it happening over and over again in the Gospels. It reminds us in John 10, we are told a thief comes to steal, kill, and destroy, but Jesus came that we would have life and what? Have it abundantly. It's not that we get limited, we get only partial space, but it's an abundance that he came to give. In John 15, it goes on to say, "I have told you these things so that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be complete." You see, that's what he's saying. This, in this one moment with the wine, he is wrapping it all up. That what God is about in this moment is about abundance, and it's about fullness of joy, and that Jesus has come to reveal that to us, and that's why John opens up. It could have been some just feeding of thousands of people or walking on water or raising the dead, but no, we're going to say God is about the abundance of joy. We're inviting you into something that is bigger and better than we can do on our own. There is something profound in this miracle that Jesus begins to open up for us. This miracle is going to begin to set the stage. Now, there's two last clues, and I want to wrap with these because I got to get to the end of this one. There's more coming in these next few weeks. They're going to be awesome as we look at how God moves and how he wants to teach us some things. There are two keys in the clues in the way John sets this up. First one is this. It is that extravagance. It is that extravagance that convinces Jesus' disciples. Notice at the end of the verse when it says, "And from here the disciples believed." It wasn't just that he was a miracle worker, but he was a miracle worker who was revealing the heart of God, which is so good for you and me. That is beyond what we deserve. It is more than we can imagine. It is there for us if we will trust him, much like the words he spoke to his mom. The average partygoer didn't know anything even happened, but the disciples saw it. And I don't know what happened to the servants, but they saw it. And I've got to believe that they became followers that day as well. They saw that this Jesus was something different than they had seen before. And this other clue is at the beginning. Notice how John introduces the whole story. On the third day. Now, it could be that it was just a Tuesday, like any other Tuesday. But what other on the third day does that begin to resonate with as we think about the context of John's story about the life of Jesus? And on the third day, we hear it again, don't we? Where, Fred? On the third day, he rose. And so the gospel begins with this celebration of God's extravagance for us on the third day. setting the stage so that we know when we get to the end of the story and Jesus raises on the third day, it's another demonstration of God's extravagance for us. That which we didn't deserve, this grace which we cannot earn, is offered to us, and it is being kind of mirrored for us in this small little way with this turning water into wine and revealing God's heart for us, which is going to begin to help us understand when the resurrection happens, that is God's love demonstrated for us. It is interesting as John wraps this up that those two pieces kind of bookend the story and tell us it is that extravagance of God that draws us to himself, but it is a bigger picture, which he's beginning to set us up to understand. Miracle sets for us the stage for that other third day where that grace is revealed in the wine that day. Jesus would later use the wine as a reminder at the Passover meal to reveal his grace again, that grace of God which has no limits. When he took the cup at the Passover meal and said, "This is my blood which is poured out for you," the blood of the new covenant. You don't earn it. You don't deserve it. You can't buy it. It is yours because of the extravagant nature of God's grace to you. He did that following the meal where he had taken the bread and having broke it, he offered it and said, "This is broken, and it is for you." Taking the cup and blessing it, he invited them to come and partake in his goodness. So let us prepare our hearts to receive God's extravagance once again. Father, we give you thanks on this day that you desire to meet us here, to bless us, to give us more than we deserve, to invite us to experience more of you in the midst of our life, to touch us in those places where we are broken, where we are hurting, where we are jagged, and where life doesn't make sense, to come into those places where we fear embarrassment or some sense of humiliation or fear the uncertainty of what the future may hold. We come to you even out of these broken places in our relationships, that the imperfections of ourself as well as those around us, and we receive this grace extended to us. God, we thank you that though we cannot control you, God, that your desire is to meet us where we are and to bring yourself into it. So bless us as we come to receive these elements, reminders that we are invited to draw near and to trust you. In Jesus' name, amen.